I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 1087. John Brenneman and John Van Landingham. Is that right? You get that close enough? Welcome, gentlemen, and please introduce yourselves and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Brenneman. I represent the manufactured housing communities in Oregon. Senate Bill 1087 started out as several issues, but in trying to reach some consensus with residents of our parks, they allowed us to redo Section 4 into a new Section 1, who I got John Van Landingham, who was sitting with me here to help me work on it. And then I spent the weekend trying to hand engross those dash 2 amendments, and as pointed out to all of you, I got a little bit of a problem doing it correctly in sub 4 and section 1, but the idea behind this loan issue that's left is that fees owing the landlord are to be paid before approving that new owner and allowing them to stay in the park. And appreciate the fact that John worked with me on this to construct the dash 2 amendments, and I would hope, at least I think at this point, we don't have anybody opposing that portion and would like to move just this one section.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
John Van Landingham of Lane County Law and Advocacy. I represent low-income tenants, and I worked with the resident groups on this issue, and we fully support 1087-2.
We don't have any engrossed. We don't have them. Okay. Are these the dash 2s? We got them now?
Yep.
Okay. And then we also have a copy of a Hannah Gross proposal of the dash 2s. Okay. Any comments or questions? Chair would entertain a motion, or Chair would move to accept the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1087. Any comments, objections? So ordered. Chair would move Senate Bill 1087 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Objections? So ordered. Let it carry there. I just like to carry that. Okay, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1088. And John, why don't you come back up again? And we have a, this is a work session, excuse me, I better open up a work session on Senate Bill 1088, excuse me. And we have some dash 3 amendments. Do you want to discuss those and bring the committee up to date?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham of Lane County Law and Advocacy again. The dash 3 amendments incorporate the dash 1 amendments, which you saw at a public hearing on April 12th, an amendment from the state, a minor amendment from the state, some corrections that I made to LC's draft of my draft. And I would say that the negotiating group on 1088 continues to support 1088-3.
Okay. Any questions? Do you have some comments? Okay. Yeah, are there any questions from the committee at this point? We have some other folks who would like to testify as the proposed amendments. What did I do with my list here? Mr. Kerr or Mr. Cook, please come up. I know I have it here somewhere. Welcome, gentlemen, and please introduce yourselves. And,
thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Kerr. With family and some friends, we own two small mobile home parks, or trailer parks, really. They were built in the late 1940s in Portland. Actually, one of them may be much older than that. My understanding is that it was originally built by the family of Representative Edith Green, so it's a very old trailer park that probably dates back in the 30s. We also have a mobile home park in Corvallis and an old mobile home trailer park down in Medford. There are some provisions of SB 1088-3 that we are concerned about. Mr. Cook and I and Mr. Cook will have some testimony in a moment. Our concern in part arises from the fact that these amendments that were before your committee initially on April 2nd did not come into print. I'm sorry, on April 12th did not come into print until sometime later, and have not really had any wide distribution or discussion or review by other park owners. I was able to obtain some copies of them, as was Mr. Cook, and we have spoken with other park owners. If we had been aware that there would be an opportunity for public testimony today, I'm sure that others would have been here to speak against the bill. Our concerns deal primarily with two sections of the bill. On page 5, section 4.2, which, beginning at the bottom of the page, going over to page 6, This is on the dash three amendment, which is before you now.
So we're on page 5.
Page 5, section 4.2, and carrying over onto the second page. These amendments make a substantive change in what has been the relationship between mobile home park owners, trailer park owners, and the residents. As I've explained, in many cases, we have very old parks that have very old trailers in them. And I have some photographs to illustrate what I'm talking about, so I'd like to share with the committee. And we have taken a position in the past that we would allow these units to remain with the understanding that at some time in the future, and let's face it, we're moving into the 21st century, that 40-plus-year-old trailers would someday be removed from our property. This bill leaves, puts into perpetuity the existence of these very old trailers. In many cases, these do not meet, and specifically are exempted here, from any construction standards that have ever been in effect in the state of Oregon. Many of these old trailers have aluminum wiring, and over time are going to pose problems, safety problems, health and safety problems for the people who purchase them. There's no requirement that anybody disclose to a prospective purchaser the condition of the home, whether or not it meets safety standards, or any requirements that went into transfer to be brought into compliance and made safe. But again, there is an essential property right, in a sense, that is in there, that is taken from us, and that is the right to eventually get our property back. The other provision that we're particularly concerned about is in draft in the dash 3 amendments. Here's on page 58. Beginning on line 19. This provision extends to someone whose tenant who has been evicted from a mobile home park the right to leave their property on our space, on our property, for up to at least a year, if not longer, and gives them the right then to remain in possession, in effect, of our property so that they can sell the mobile home, or trailer, as it may be, because it may be a very old one. The concern that we have is one of fairness, really. As I've explained, I was raised in a time perhaps a little bit differently, and I was taught by my parents that my actions had consequences. And if we go into court and we are successful in evicting somebody, it is a very difficult task to evict someone. But if a court orders that the person who has been evicted needs to face those consequences, and that consequence would be that they and their property should be removed from my property. In the past, we've had some circumstances that have involved, for example, drug dealing. And these are not, if you are familiar with it and it happens in every neighborhood, the sign is traffic that's in and out of the neighborhood. And it's cars that stop and go. And it's the neighbors who are complaining about that kind of situation. It's very difficult, of course, to try and actually get someone convicted of drug possession or drug dealing. But there is a pattern of activity that affects the neighbors. If we have to go in on an eviction of someone because of that pattern of activity, we're stuck. We have to have the tenants, the neighbors, be willing to go into court to testify as to what has happened. Sometimes, and the neighbors are very concerned about doing that. Often they are afraid of the person who is engaged in this activity. And they do not want to have to be testify against them. Sometimes by bringing our case and heading it down there into the courts, we're able to arrive at a stipulated agreement. And the reason that we can get that stipulated agreement is because the person that's causing the problem awakens to the fact that if they go to trial and they lose, the consequence will be that they cannot sell their mobile home to remain on the space. And that's because there is that consequence that's there, that we're able to get that stipulated agreement. If this consequence is removed, we will then be forced to have to go to trial. We will then have to bring in those neighbors who are witnesses who do not want to testify, but we will have to subpoena them. We will have to subpoena them and force them to testify to those complaints that they are now making to us. This bill, then, brings into play the law of unintended consequences. And I don't think this committee and others have been made aware of what the impacts of this legislation can have when, very simply, you remove consequences from people's behavior. And again, I come back to the basic premise that this is a property rights issue. If someone's tenancy has ended with us, particularly if it's through the action of a court, then we should be able to get our property back. And so these are the issues that we feel are not properly dealt with in this bill, and we would ask that the bill be held in committee and these amendments be drafted to either remove these provisions or to substantially rewrite it.
Okay. Any questions?
My name is Paul Cook, spelled K-O-C-H. I live in Milwaukee, 17414 Southeast Oakfield Road. I own three parts, 150 units in Estacada, 151 units in Milwaukee, and 140 units in the Gila. And as you know, the final draft three amendments of the 1088, draft three form, was not available in printed form until Friday morning. It is my feeling that that has placed some of us in a difficult position to analyze the bill, and yet I respect the process that you're faced with, and I find no great fault with that. On the other hand, I also must testify to the fact that I think from my personal experience that as a member of our association, I really was not fully informed of the consequences of this bill. Even though I attended the chapter meeting, it occurred after your hearing of April 12th, and I didn't feel, from my personal view, that we've had a good communication concerning the consequences of the bill. My other thing is that I think, in good conscience, folks have attempted to cure some problems. I recognize those problems in a considerably different perspective. I don't think we're talking about senior folks. I don't think we're talking about the respected people. Fortunately for us, those constitute the vast majority. And so we enjoy that and appreciate that. However, it does also include some folks with whom I've had some very, very serious difficulty. Except to bring up the audience a little bit to speed, in my memory to you, Mr. Chairman, I related some of the specific instances that we have had to deal with. One, drunken man discharging firearms within the park, and there's no law that says he can't discharge a firearm to the county. I've had wife beaters. I've had children left in homes with dog feces around the floor. I've had, fortunately, we were saved from one person who lived as a family member, stayed in the home when his parents vacated, an adult person, and we were saved from his activities by three sheriffs who descended upon the park one night with guns drawn and took him away in handcuffs. Now, those are the people that this bill proposes that we deal with ad infinitum so that they can stay in the park, home can stay in the park, and we have to grant access for marketing, whatever. They've already demonstrated their irresponsibility. The possibility of dealing with those folks is almost nil, constructively. And so I'd just submit to you that this bill, in its implications and owner's characteristics, probably are not what everybody intended. We were not asked to comment about the bill, but I can tell you these things happened to me personally, and I became personally involved, and these are the folks that we have to have the ability. Tom spoke about the older homes. I've had two fires associated with aluminum wirings of these older homes. And that clearly demonstrates the fact that we have to be aware and sensitive to some of the risks that some of these homes provide for us. And so I urge you to revisit this in some detail and deal with the matter of removal, condition of homes, and those things for which our other tenants hold us responsible to provide a safe environment. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, sir, for coming. Any questions? Senator Metzger.
Yes, for either one of you gentlemen, I believe is rather clear in the legislation, is it not, that any repairs that are necessary that you can require of the tenant, you talked about faulty electrical, that is certainly allowed, and you can mandate that those things be corrected. In this legislation, there's nothing that would prohibit you as a landlord, is there not?
Yes, there is. We cannot require that the wiring in the mobile home be replaced. No, the only thing that...
I didn't say be replaced. I said if it was in disrepair, you can certainly challenge that. And Mr. McMahon, I mean, if you have any questions on to add to that, please do.
Well, again, I think... It creates a very awkward kind of situation. You are correct that under this measure we can now proceed against trailers that we have in the past allowed to remain. But we now have, under this, we will now proceed against those. But I don't know that that's the consequence that you really intend to have. I mean, instead of our saying that trailer can remain there until it is sold at some time in the future, this bill now says that we have to place those requirements on the person, the elderly person who lives there, who does not have the money to repair that mobile home. But we have to do it now. We can't say when it is sold, be removed, or be upgraded. We now go after the elderly person, do it now. And I don't know, Senator, that's what you want to happen.
Well, I would say, Mr. Chair, since this was the project of our work group and our citizens in those homes are very content with that, that would seem to be their issue, not so much yours.
Well, Senator, I hate to be sitting back here in front of this committee in a couple of years with people coming back and saying, look at what has happened here. These homes that were allowed to stay, now the park owners are coming to these people, these elderly people, and saying, you must do it now. We cannot wait until it is sold. You know, that's what you're going to hear in 2 years.
Mr. Hammond.
Yes, sir.
Just knowing I did step out for a moment, but I wanted to get back to what you also mentioned, since we're on the same theme of seniors. You were commenting on the older homes and your desire to be able to have the ability to move them out simply because of their age. And I guess it fails on me as to why someone, and most likely would be those same seniors you're talking about, where you would find it's okay to go ahead and force them out of your park simply because their home is old and not because it's in disrepair, but was built prior to a time in which you preferred to have homes in your park.
No, Senator, that is not what I said. That is not what we said. We said that under the current law, right, the current law says that I may not require a mobile home to be removed upon its sale. All right? It says, though, that I can eventually put in, if you own the mobile home today and you wanted to sell it, unless there's something in my agreement with you that says when it's sold, you must remove it. I cannot do that. But if you sell it to Senator Starr, I can put into that agreement that when Senator Starr sells it, it must be removed from the park. So Senator Starr knows that when it comes in. He knows that when the time comes that he sells it, that it goes. But I don't have to take any action against that mobile, that trailer while Senator Starr is there. Excuse me, Senator, putting in the trailer. But now you are telling me that if Senator Starr's trailer looks like one of these, okay, I must now go after that trailer, and I must now force an elderly person who now lives in it to upgrade that mobile home, that trailer. And I'm saying to you, Senator, that these trailers that went into this park in the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
okay, ought to at some time be removed at the time of sale. I don't want to go after the people today, but that's what this bill does.
Mr. Chair, I think you're turning this around. If you look at page 5, which is what you asked us to highlight, where it says specifically, a landlord shall not require removal of a manufactured dwelling or consider a dwelling or home to be in disrepair or deteriorated because of age, size, style, or original construction material. And that's what you objected to. That is specifically the thing that is going to protect people from having landlords kick people out simply because of that requirement. That is the protection that you have disputed.
Senator, you know, this already, you are correct. I will not be able to require this mobile home to be removed at the time of its sale because it is an old 1950s trailer with aluminum wire. That is absolutely correct. What you put in here instead is the mechanism for me to go after this 1950s trailer, now, and make the person who lives there now upgrade it, even though they may not have the money to do it. You have not given me the opportunity to say, I will continue to put up with this thing because I am sympathetic to your situation. But when the time comes to sell it, it's got to go, or it's got to be upgraded. It's got to be fixed up. No. It goes now. That action has to start now against the person who may not have the capacity to bring it up to standards.
Well, I appreciate your consideration of the tenants on that. Mr. Van Langenham, could I ask for a response?
Sure, yes. John, would you have a yes or a response? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nestor, if I could, I would like to do a full response to the assertions that Mr. Kerr and Mr. Cook have made. I've seen a letter that was sent to you all over the weekend from Mr. Kerr. I saw it this morning, and I'm prepared to respond. And I think it would be of value to you if I could do that in an organized way, but rather than pick and choose questions. Because I think that my organized response will answer, hopefully answer your concerns. Let me first say that this issue, which we in the negotiation group have called termination and removal or forced removal, has been the residents' number one legislative issue since 1997. They raised it in the 97 legislature. It was not time to work out a compromise solution. They made a commitment with the landlord groups to come back and work on it. This is a product of that commitment. The issue is much broader than Mr. Kerr has described it. It is whether a landlord can require a home to be removed from the park solely due to its age, its size, its condition, in terms of how it was built, what material it was used, regardless of whether it's in good condition or fine condition. In our negotiations, we became fully aware that there are many older homes that are in better condition than newer homes. We are restricting here the ability of a landlord to say to someone, your home is 10 years old, or your home is a single wide, and I don't care that it's in fine condition, you must remove it, or that your buyer must remove it. Regardless of your conduct, these are good tenants. We're not saying that they've done something wrong that merits eviction. We're saying that they would be forced to remove the home or not to sell it, not be able to sell it because of its age, size, condition. Now, there are incidents, reported incidents of landlords in the state who are saying that very thing to tenants and who have attempted to amend their rental agreements to make that point, that they can do that. A manufactured home without a space is virtually worthless. We promote manufactured housing living in this state as affordable, as a means of home ownership that provides the independence of home ownership and allows you to build up equity. If you don't have a space, you've lost your equity. The home is worthless. The most adamant members of our group, our negotiating group, on the need to resolve this problem were lenders. Washington Mutual makes millions of dollars in loans in the Northwest a month on manufactured housing. Beneficial Finance, the same. They have said that they would be afraid to make the loans in the future because it's not just the tenant's equity which is at stake, it's their security interest. Because they would be in the same boat. The home without a space is worthless. And if a landlord can require a home to be removed at the landlord's discretion, then that jeopardizes the tenant's security and the lender's security. Imagine that concept for your own home. If you wanted to sell your own home, you were told that you could sell it, but the buyer would have to move it. I don't imagine any of us would appreciate someone having that power over our home investment. Every issue that Mr. Kerr has raised today was debated at length in the negotiating group. This is, I believe, the most negotiated issue you will see in this session. It's certainly the most negotiated issue I've worked on in my five sessions of drafting landlord-tenant amendments. The negotiating group first started to discuss this in February of 1998, more than a year ago. We've had more than 20 meetings to work on this issue alone. It went through 15 drafts. We went through 10 drafts and signed off on it in late January before one of the landlord group's lawyer came in and said, no, I've got problems. So we went through five more drafts, and those five more drafts added many changes which protected landlord interests further. And as I said, we discussed every one of the issues that Mr. Kerr has raised. The negotiating group included three different landlord groups representing hundreds of parks. Mr. Kerr has stated in his letter that nobody in that group was an owner. One of the groups, Manufactured Housing Community of Oregon, MHCO, had as its representative Sally Harrington, who works for Commonwealth Real Estate, which manages dozens of parks, and its members own some parks. I met personally at the last minute with the MHCO board, many of whom are owners, to discuss this very issue alone for over an hour. The negotiating group also included a lawyer from Portland who represents only park owners and, I believe, represents Mr. Kerr personally. That lawyer participated in the group. That lawyer was aware of the negotiations. We finished the 15th draft in February. The legislature printed this bill on April the 9th in -1. So it has been available to the public, termination removal issue, since April 9th. To be specific about a couple of the issues that Ms. Kerr mentioned, the bill itself does not mention drug dealers or do anything to help or hurt drug dealers. And in fact, in other parts of the bill, we have strengthened the right, clarified the right of landlords, as Senator Metzger was trying to point out, clarify the right of a landlord to require the removal of a home because it's in disrepair or deterioration. There is nothing in the manufactured housing sections now which clearly addresses that. In fact, right now, the current law, 90.630, simply addresses the conduct of the tenant. What we're talking about here is deterioration. If a home is in deterioration, the landlord, under this bill, can require it to be removed at any time, If Mr. Kerr wishes to take to be kind to the little old lady who can't afford repairs, he does not have to require removal then. He can wait any time that a home is in disrepair, whether it's while the little old lady can't afford the repairs or when she dies and her wealthy son comes in. He can require the removal then if it's in disrepair. And in fact, this bill makes that absolutely clear. This bill does not require Mr. Kerr to allow anybody who's a former tenant to enter the premises, drug dealer or not. I might note that drug dealers are more likely to lose their home through forfeiture by the state than to have to go through any of this process. But anybody who is no longer a tenant, it, as provided by this bill for the first time, can only enter the premises after the tenancy terminates with a written permission of the landlord. There is nothing in current law which says that. We have made many changes here which benefit both sides. This is a compromise bill negotiated to my exhaustion. I believe that it's a fair bill. Thank you.
Mr. Kerr, you have a response to that?
Yes, I do. Mr. Van Lanningham has made a very important point, I think, and that is that he has emphasized that the purpose is promotion of manufactured housing, and he's made the point about Washington Mutual reluctance to lend and its significance in lending on manufactured housing. But I'm not talking about manufactured housing, as Mr. Van Lanningham is. I'm talking about old trailers. Washington Mutual will not lend on these trailers. These trailers will not be financed by Washington Mutual because they won't do anything with these old ones. This bill does not stop at prohibition against requiring the removal of manufactured housing. It specifically states that the park owner cannot require the removal of something that does not meet any building standards. You know, what we're talking about this bill doing is going further. It goes, you know, it puts into perpetuity the right to occupy the space by these old trailers. Mr. Van Lanningham says, you know, that this, what would happen if this were your home, and I think he refers to a conventional home. Well, Senators, when you sell your home, you have to make disclosures to the buyer as to the condition of the home. There is no requirement that a seller who's going to sell one of these old trailers that the lenders won't finance because of their age, style, and condition, that the owner of that trailer has to make any disclosures to the seller as to whether or not it has aluminum wiring, whether the plumbing is in bad shape, or any of those things. This bill does not give us any ability to deal with the things which are internal to this mobile home. We've had situations. I had one down in Corvallis this summer where the tenants had torn the house apart. They had ripped the toilets off of it, off the floors, they had yanked the wiring out of the walls, and they had done all kinds of things to the interior of that house. They could sell that house to remain on the space. There is no state standard that applies on that kind of thing. You know, and so if you're going to go this far, then you need to protect the purchaser. You need to require that there be disclosures as to the condition and safety and inspection. You know, when you sell your conventional home, an informed buyer is going to have an inspection made of that house. There's no protection in this bill for buyers.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. We're running short of time. We have two more witnesses we need to...
John Dang, just on the last point. The amendments to 90.680 do expressly, for the first time, require that a selling tenant notify a buying potential buyer of any outstanding notice for disrepair.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Appreciate your coming up to testify. We need Sally Harrington and Emily Cederley. Okay, hate to cut you off in a short time, but we do have a little time now. If you could summarize and speak from the heart, we'd appreciate
it. For the record, my name is Sally Harrington. I am the legislative chair for Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and I'm also the vice president of Commonwealth Property Management. We manage over 75 parks in the state of Oregon. There are a couple issues raised in this that John Van Landingham had indicated that I think need to be reiterated, and that is that if a tenant is evicted or resident is evicted from a home, they cannot come back into the park for any circumstances without written permission from the landlord, whether they're selling their home, maintaining it, or otherwise. So if Mr. Kerr's concern about residents are evicted because of drug dealing or whatever, this would prevent that. Having managed as many parks as we do manage and we have over the years, you know, I would like to testify that I've had several homes that have burned in the last several years that have been newer homes that were not burned because of the wiring. And I think that that needs to be something that needs to be stated. And the other thing is Mr. Kerr's statement that current law now allows him, if Senator Metzger sells the home to Senator Starr, that Senator Starr can leave it there until he sells it in its present condition. And I guess my concern is, why isn't there a concern for the wiring during the whole tenancy of Mr. Starr's tenancy rather than when somebody gets to sell the home? The landlord, this law allows the landlord to give notice to existing residents to repair the home for safety or health issues by giving a 30-day notice. And if they don't do it, the home is to be removed. If it's not a safety or health issue, they're allowed an extension of 60 days if so required. But the group mediated on this and discussed that the health and safety issue should be a 30-day notice to repair it or remove it. And that's something that we did. And the last thing I'd like to say in my closing is that unless you have a judgment when you evict a resident right now, that the judgment states that the landlord is also titled, that the resident is also required to move the home, you are only evicting the resident. You are not evicting the home. And the home is either sold or abandoned under current law unless the judge states in the judgment that the home has to be evicted at that, removed at that time. This group has spent a tremendous amount of time. We've talked to the owners. I've gone before our board of directors. I've gone before our legislative committee, and I've gone before our executive committee. Flyers and mailings were sent out regarding this bill to all park owners that are members of MHCO, and unless they're not a member of MHCO, then they have been informed, and they should have been informed. Thank you very much for your time.
You're in support of the bill. That's what you're telling me.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Emily, please introduce yourself.
I'm Emily Cedarly, the Executive Director of Multifamily Housing Council, which is one of the three associations in the state that represent mobile home parks as well as residential tenancies. I've been on the job since 1980 and been involved in every landlord-tenant bill until this session. And I apologize I did not appear before your hearing the first time. My parents are 95 and 97, and my 95-year-old mother died Easter Sunday. I had 36 hours to leave town and get to Chicago, and so I apologize that I wasn't present. I think it's the only time I've ever missed a hearing regarding landlord-tenant. There are several things that I talked to Mr. Kerr in the hallway about and some things that John has given you the background on. We support the bill, and of the issue of forced removal, which is what we started calling this thing, we did spend a substantial amount of time. I took a fair amount of time last fall and drove through mobile home parks. And when I saw some of these homes that were well maintained, beautiful landscaping, in good condition, I started thinking, what's wrong with why can't they sell? One of the owners of one of those structures showed me that when she bought the structure the first time, the previous owner had paid $10,000 for it. She had paid $5,000 for it, and now she was having trouble selling it because her rental agreement contained a provision that says, if you sell this structure, it cannot remain on the space. It was the most beautiful place in the park as far as landscaping and exterior condition, and the interior matched her personality, which showed outside. And she said, if I sell it for $1,000, I'd be lucky. That's when I began to realize that tenants are sometimes a choice of housing, whether they're residential or mobile home, but they're not second-class citizens. And I firmly believe in the Oregon Constitution that protects private property rights. Yes, it's my right, and I have rights as an owner to the property that structure is on. But when you look at the last section of this bill, what we have said is if it's conditioned I can tell you as you go along so you don't devalue other structures in the park and you don't devalue my property as a landlord. I can give that as I go along. Under the Fair Housing Act, age is not protection. So I can choose to wait for a senior citizen that doesn't have the money and say, if you sell it, you've got to take care of the exterior things that we've let go. But for this period of time, I know that you're only living on $495 a month and that you can't afford it. On the other thing, if we're evicting because of conduct or we're truly wanting to keep that resident off, when the argument says, well, it's one of the sticks that we can use for a tenant that they're going to lose the value of their structure, that's not my purpose. If you're a bad actor, I want you off the property. I can get an eviction that keeps you off the property. The structure stays there. And you, the tenant, or former tenant now, will have to pay somebody to come in and maintain that structure, pay somebody to handle it, to sell it, and you, the former tenant, cannot enter my property without written permission. And if you violate that, I can have you arrested as a trespasser. There is a broad scope to this issue, and it is very volatile. It is volatile both for the landlords and the tenants. Yes, there were times that I thought we were giving up property rights, but I don't believe so anymore because we cleaned up all of those areas as clear as we could. As far as the shootings and the drug activity, under the statute 90400 sub 6, it tells me that proof by preponderance of the evidence, which means that a reasonable person in a community finds your activities outrageous. Manufacturer of delivery of controlled substance, shooting a gun, I believe, would be outrageous conduct. I don't have to give you a 30-day notice in a mobile home park. I can give you a 24-hour notice that says, you stay off this premises, and I can get a restraining order to keep you off of it until I get into court for the eviction approximately 2 weeks later. We've done it as landlords. We've had to use it. So some of the arguments are all covered. The difficulty is recognizing the words. I will admit that there are a couple minor things that are wrong with this bill because of legislative council's drafting that we can fix on the House side. There are things where they put cross sightings in that don't apply to the mobile home section of the statute, but there is nothing that is so detrimental that the bill shouldn't pass, and I urge the passage of Senate Bill 1088.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, we are work session. Chair would move dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1088. Any comments? Objections? So orders. Chair would move Senate Bill 1088 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Comments? Objections? So orders. Senator Metzger, do you want to carry this?
Happy to.
Okay. Open up the open up public hearings on Senate Bill 785 and Senate Bill 1239. Okay. What, Scott Scotton, is that right? Fan, oh, excuse me. I just transferred the words around. That's not good, is it? Scott Stanton? Stan Scotton, excuse me. Tom Phillips, Richard Rogers, and Jane Cummings, if you could get up close there anyway. How are you doing? I don't know, I just looked at those things and I just got transformed.
Nothing all the time.
Well, let's see, who wants to start here with this group? So please start and introduce yourself and proceed.
My name is Sam Sutton. I'm employed by the City of Portland Office of Planning and Development Review, and I'm the training coordinator for the office. I'm also the education chair of the Oregon Building Officials Association, and as a result of that, a member of the Oregon Building Officials Association Board. This was legislation that was proposed by the Oregon Building Officials Association. This legislation follows up on a work group that we had with the Building Codes Division, and this is an additional path that would not detract from the current certification and training rules, but would add to that and would give the building official more responsibility for determining who could sit for certification as an instructor or a plans examiner. and do building code enforcement in the state of Oregon. I've been working as training coordinator for the office for about 10 years, and I personally have participated in probably six or seven certification and training rule rewrites. I have also served on the old certification training advisory board, which was disbanded, I believe, in 91. So I'm familiar with these rules. This work group that put this together this last time, I thought, came up with a very inventive approach. This is new and different than anything you've thought about or proposed before. I believe it provides more opportunity to get people into the profession, to get quality people into the profession, and yet maintain the integrity of that business. What it would do would be to transfer some of that authority again from what's been exclusively the domain of the building code division to the local building official. And cities, counties, and actually the state has their building official also. And this would shift that to them, again, as an alternate path. So that there's still rule and statute available to hold that building official responsible for any of their determinations that they might make. And all this is really doing would be to allow the work group to work with the building code division to promulgate rules regarding this issue. Now, two things specifically. Why do we need this additional approach? Why do we need this alternate path? One of our concerns as the organization, and specifically with the City of Portland, we're having a hard time finding good qualified applicants. And the process that's currently in place, while it recognizes a person's experience in a construction field and their ability to take a test, it really doesn't always guarantee us that we have someone that can communicate, provide customer service, and works well with others. So that's the kind of the building official's domain. And we need to have a little bit more flexibility to be able to get the people that we're interested in into the profession. I had another point, and I lose my first time. I had another point, but I forgot it, so that's enough.
If you think about it, the rest of them will surely give you an opportunity. Please introduce yourself, sir, and proceed.
My name's Richard Rogers. I'm representing Blazer Industries. I'm a member of the Building Code Structures Board, and I'm not speaking on their behalf. Keep that clear. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I worked on the certification experience work group as well with Stan and several other people, and I thought we had a really good cross-pollinization of stakeholders on this issue, speaking to Senate Bill 785. And if this could be something that could help us to move that along, I think it's really important. We, as a consumer of inspection services, we see both sides of the spectrum as far as the quality of people that come out of the generally out of the Schmeckeder program is usually what we see. And there are very good people coming out of there, and people who probably should not be in this profession coming out of there. And we end up having to educate them at our expense in our facility as a commercial modular builder. We're very much interested in seeing the most qualified people being hired, and we believe that this would do that. We've heard of situations where people coming up out of California with possibly 10 years of experience and can't get a job in Oregon because of our certification. And we have in the state created a level of that's I believe New Jersey maybe has an equal program as far as certification for inspectors, and we don't want to move away from that level of qualification and that quality of inspection, but certification doesn't always assure quality, and we want to be able to see that alternate path where qualified people can come here through this alternate path. I don't believe we're giving away anything as far as what we're going to ultimately qualify. It's not appropriate to bring up what the certification group came up with, but I thought it was a very good alternate path. It shouldn't require things. It shouldn't require training. I think it's something that's very needed so that we can see the most qualified people getting into these positions. That's the Senate Bill 1239. The copy I have, I think, is lacking a little bit in some of the language, but I'm still in favor of the thrust of it. And that is, again, to provide some kind of vehicle where the most qualified people can come from one level of an inspector through some kind of training or something. I don't think we should just make a blanket statement that if you're certified under ORS 455, then you get to serve the plumbing inspector. I don't think that's appropriate, but I believe that with a little bit of work, the thrust of the bill is appropriate.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I am Tom Phillips. I'm new to the state. I was hired back in June. I'm the building official for the city of Astoria and city of Warrenton. I've been asked to basically give you my testimony of how I got to this state and the process that I had to go through. A couple years ago, I had put an application in for a building official position in North Bend. At the time, there were 3 applicants. And I came in, and through the interview, I found out that I had to have state certifications. I had my International Conference of Building Officials certification in plan design, building inspecting, and in plumbing inspecting. And they had alerted me at that point that I had to have the state's inspections before I actually could inspect. So I backed out of that one because it was a little bit too rushed for me. So just recently, back last spring, I put in for 3 positions in the state. I'd done my homework and talked to the Building Codes Division on the requirements needed for the certifications. They were very helpful and very cooperative with me. I have nothing but positive things to say about the Building Codes Division. But anyway, I went to the 3 interviews. One was in Grants Pass as a building inspector 2, one was in Salem as a senior plans examiner, and then one was in Astoria, Warrenton as a building official. In Grants Pass, there was 2 applicants. I was one of them from Idaho, and the other one was from California. In Salem, there was 3 applicants. I was one of them from Idaho for the position. In Astoria, there was only 2 applicants, me from Idaho and an individual from California also. I say that to say that there was a pretty shallow, or not, maybe shallow is not the right word, but how about a deep pool of applicants for these jurisdictions to pull from. One of the things that they had asked me right off the bat was, are you certifiable? And certainly I took that 2 different ways, but one of the ways that I did take that was that I'd done my homework and found out I was certifiable, but they were openly frustrated with the fact that they couldn't make a commitment to me. They couldn't look at my qualifications as a building inspector. They couldn't look at who I was as an individual without first passing through that veil of certification, without first knowing that I could fit for this test. And that seemed to frustrate them, and I noticed they openly talked to me about that because they were frustrated that the pool was very shallow, not deep, with applicants, but also that they couldn't make a real commitment to me unless I passed these tests, obviously, or mainly unless I could sit for them. And so I'd received verification from the Building Codes Division saying that I could sit for those, and for a couple of them, but a couple I hadn't received yet. So, but I wanted to make sure I gave you that point that there was a frustration on the end of building officials. And now that I'm a building official, because I got to tell you first that I was selected for all 3 jobs. And it wasn't because I was the bright and shining star. There just wasn't a whole lot to pick from. And but I did select the Astoria Warrenton job, and now acting as the building official, I am concerned that the building official doesn't have a little bit of latitude to act as a manager, to be able to select the best qualified individual all around, which would be not just how good he hammered nails in the years before, or how good he can take a test, but what quality of a person do we have as far as in customer service, problem solving and working with the professionals in the community. So that's why I'm sitting here today, to give you that testimony, because I believe that it is important for the billing official to be able to select what he or she would believe is the best qualified individual for the job.
Stan, did you think of your other points?
I don't know if everybody's done. I'm sure you don't read your ordinance that often, but we've been advertising, we've had an open recruitment for over a year for building inspector, plan examiner, plumbing inspector, and electrical inspector. And it's not because we don't have applicants who have the certifications, but again, it's applicants that don't have those missing pieces. And as you're also aware, I'm sure, construction is beginning to take off again in Oregon. We were told it was supposed to level out for a couple of years. It isn't happening. It's booming again, and we need good people. And as a building department, you're not inclined to send out marginal people because you work independently. Hopefully, will allow us to do some better recruiting, some pre-qualify some people, and get them into the process so we can get them working and fulfill those needs that we have to our customers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alan. Any questions I should ask? You guys? Jane, Bill, do you want to come up too? Bill Cross? Jane, too?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jane Cummins with the City of Oregon City. And now, as I understand it, you're taking testimony on both 785 and 1239, because I'll try, my comments are going to be brief and fairly general. I guess I have to say, if there is one issue that even city managers are aware about with building inspection programs, it's the certification issue. For years, they have expressed their frustration at not being able to get a strong enough pool for their local program to choose from, or even in the past who have been able to advertise out of state in some cases. In fact, they used to scratch their heads and express their puzzlement at why this doesn't seem to work and it doesn't make sense. So I think we can say that if there are methods of broadening the pool and putting into that pool well-qualified folks without sacrificing safety, then the effort is well worth it. And I think what you've heard is that there have been a number of attempts and work groups and rulemakings over the years, and the work continues to go on to improve the system, and I think that's an indication that we still have a ways to go. I followed a little bit the efforts of the work group that met last year. I understood earlier this year that a hearing was supposed to be conducted but was canceled. But you have this bill in front of you that does give some direction, and I think that an alternate path is especially appropriate in this area. And again, I think we'd stress that this is not an attempt to go around the methodologies that are in place now. It's not an attempt to sacrifice anything to do with safety. It's to add to the system, to strengthen the system, and to be able to meet the demands that are out there as construction continues to boom in various parts of Oregon.
Okay, if I could just have one quick question. You know, we're doing what, 511 and 587? Is it 511 or 512? 512 and 587. What are the common threads? And I know the cities are opposed to those two bills, but you're in favor of these bills.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think our general position has been that Oregon has a statewide building code that is implemented traditionally at the local jurisdiction level, and that the state has a continuing role to play in the adoption of codes and the interpretations and training and assistance to local jurisdictions. And in that assistance, because we do not have a program where it is easy for jurisdictions to, let's say, establish and grow into we'll call full-service programs, we think that there needs to be some extra effort there. And that's where these two bills, I think, come into play. It's in that area of helping the local jurisdictions do the work in a better fashion. At times I have remarked that I think local jurisdictions are asked to do the job with one hand tied behind their back. And in fact, I won't comment on the other bills, but I think that adds to it. This is an attempt to loosen up those binds on the hands behind the back and to improve the effectiveness of local programs and the efficiency across the state.
Thank you. Bill, do you have any further questions?
Bill. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. I think you've heard about 785. Let me just reiterate that we are, in terms of labor, human resources, we have a shortage, and it's statewide, and it's in the larger programs and the smaller programs, and I can understand a customer frustration with some of the jurisdictions. They have been advertising for lengthy periods of time and find it very difficult to find individuals who are able to fill the positions from a certification standpoint. So we do need some help, and Senate Bill 785 really just takes off where a work group ended up in making recommendations. Unfortunately, the rulemaking process was postponed, and we would simply like to get that process back into play and allow a different path for an individual's experience to be assessed so that they could take a practical examination, a field evaluation, so that if they can't verify the number of hours currently required because the employer is no longer around to document it or because their experience wasn't accepted by BCD as being related to the experience that they're looking for that particular certification, yet it may, in fact, have provided some good experience for this individual, if there is a way, at least for that person, to become eligible to sit for the examination, they would still need to sit for the state's examination to become certified. So all we're looking for is an alternative. Senate Bill 1239 would... And I've got some amendments that Senator Ferrioli had drafted and prepared, the -1 amendments, which I believe have been distributed, and that's what I would like to speak to and support, because that was, I believe, the direction he was trying to go when the bill was drafted. But to require that that by rule, the Building Codes Division adopt a pathway for someone who is currently certified as a 1 and 2 family dwelling inspector who has a plumbing certification to 1 and 2 family has a path to become an A-level plumbing inspector. And right now there is none. And what we would like to see is a training program established. There again, upon completion of that training program, the individual would have to be evaluated, field tested, and pass an examination to become an A-level, but it would allow an individual to progress down that path, and right now, and the parallels with the electrical inspector as well, there's a similar provision for electrical. Both those two, in the past, the certification requirements are basically what we have for journeyman electricians or plumbers, and in the case of electrical inspectors, it's a supervising electrician. And to compete in this market where we have a pretty good building activity, and to try and compete, a jurisdiction trying to compete for individuals in those trades, it's simply not happening. They don't have the ability to match the kind of wages and salaries that those people are making in the construction industry. There again, we recognize that those individuals need to make that transition from inspecting 1 and 2 family residences to commercial buildings, both simple commercial and moving on up to high rise. But we were looking for some means of training where you might have an endorsement program so an individual could move up while they're in training and do the one-story, 4,000-square-foot commercial projects or do tenant improvements. that would be sort of that first step of A-level inspection. And then if they continue in their training and pass a final exam or a field evaluation, they could become actual A-level inspectors. So there again, we're looking for direction and opportunity for people to get into those inspection roles in a, I guess, a non-traditional manner, i.e. in the past it's really been waiting for somebody to get injured who no longer can work in the trenches, and they'll then become an inspector, or somebody who's tired of contracting after 20 years and yet still has some productivity and will become an inspector, or hoping that somebody from another state will take a job in this state, and there again they have to provide that comparable experience, and in some states they don't have the same kind of journeyman training programs. The state has extremely good programs. Our problem is once they've become a craftsperson, they're not that interested in working for a jurisdiction. So that's 1239, and that's what I believe the amendments would simply direct the Building Codes Division to, by rule, adopt a training program for individuals in 1 and 2 family certifications right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
How do you see the difference between 512 and 597 on these two bills?
I think they're aimed at some similar problems, right. customer service and the ability of jurisdictions to provide that customer service. We don't necessarily agree with the organizational format for Central 512, as you know, but many of the services that have been focused on in 512 and 587, we don't disagree with. There needs to be some better uniformity and consistency. But we also, we need to have the ability to employ the services of inspectors if, in fact, we're experiencing the kind of growth we have in some jurisdictions, and finally get the council or the county administrator or whomever to sign off on authorizing new positions, and then we can't fill them. And that's a real frustration for a number of the jurisdictions, not just in the metro area, all over.
Further questions?
Just one.
Yes, sure. Further questions.
I assume then the dash ones are yours, Bill, or the ones that you're supportive of?
Yes.
And in your written testimony, you had indicated that you thought the bill was a little too broad, and your dash ones established training examination standards as the qualifications to become a certification. Do you believe that sufficiently narrows the scope of the bill? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes, I do. It would provide, obviously, a training program and a focus for an individual who may not have had the exposure to commercial or industrial projects to become certified through, not just because you're currently a 1 and 2 electrical inspector, for example, and now you become an A-level. That would not, and that was sort of what the original draft indicated, and that I don't believe would be appropriate. It doesn't address both the training requirements that we would want to have an individual to have before we send them out to inspect, as well as the public safety aspects of being able to do the job from their own safety standpoint, as well as assuring them that they've been able to do the inspections at a qualified level, at the A level, at the commercial level. So, yes, I do believe that the dash ones provide the transition there between what you would have as your experience in 1 and 2 family inspections versus A level.
Thank you
very much.
Chuck Brewer, Gary Wright, and Deb Cook. Reggie, you want to start? Since you do live out more than 100 miles away.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to get you a testimony. Why don't you please introduce yourself and just...
You want me to go first?
Yes.
My name is Brett Cook. I'm with building officials for the City of Boardman and City of Durgan. I'm also a journeyman plumber and a Class 5 Teamsters. In reference to Senate Bill 785, I'm in opposition beginning at line 13. As a plumber in the state of Oregon, and as well as a building official, we should not, as building officials, be the ultimate authority to pick who is certified. The state of Oregon, our codes are a statewide code. They're not a regional code. And in my opinion of who is certified is going to be different or could be different than what is at the state level. Those people are trained in it. That is their job. We have criteria set for that, and it should be an impartial person determining whether that applicant is qualified or not, not dictated by the need of a jurisdiction. I'm on a plumbing board committee to review reciprocity agreements for draining plumber's license. This is not an easy task because the state of Oregon's plumbing code is completely different than Washington's or Idaho's or California. We use different fittings, we use different materials, and just because somebody is a journeyman in another state doesn't mean they're qualified to work in the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has quality, and it's well respected throughout the United States on our quality of mechanics as well as the quality of inspectors. And by allowing Senate Bill 785 to be approved, we are only filling a need because of lack of people with less quality, and that's not what we want. We want to maintain the quality, and I just don't feel this is going to be a benefit to the state at all. And in reference to 1239, I was in opposition to this bill before I saw the amendment. After I saw the amendment, I felt that this was a workable bill and that I will withdraw my opposition to Senate Bill 1239 and be in support of it. I thought the amendment did bring forth the requirement for the rules for training and experience and set rules for that, and so I thought that was a good amendment. In reference to Senate Bill 512, there's a section in Senate Bill 512 that has basically the same wording in it as Senate Bill 785 has, and that is where that committee or that board would review people and determine whether they are eligible to sit for an exam. I'm in opposition to that for the same reasons. I'm in opposition of it.
Thank you very much. Gary. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Gary Wright, representing myself and UA Local 290, the plumbers and the pipe fitters. And I guess I have to be in opposition to both bills, but we'll talk about 785 first. Thinking we have a statewide code, I'll just kind of echo some of the same testimony that Brett talked about. We have a statewide code. We need to have statewide certifications for those folks that are going to be interpreting and inspecting to that code. As far as this all goes back, and we've been fighting this battle for years, back to the old Senate Bill 35 days. So what we tried to do was to get the jurisdictions to talk to each other and share their personnel. Share your A-level inspectors. Don't everybody go out and start a program. Let's not have 33 of them like we have in the metropolitan area. Let's share those people so that they can be more efficient and work more effectively. We also created a couple, for years the building official community told us in the plumbing and electrical industry, why don't you guys create us a manpower pool of inspectors? We've got roughly 3,000 A-level, or 3,000 journeymen plumbers in the state and around 6,000 electrical journeymen. We could qualify those folks to be inspectors. We tried that. We put a little group of them together, sent out flyers to all the jurisdictions. Here we are. We can help you meet your peaks and valleys.
on a temporary basis from anywhere from a week to months. You know what? The phone never rang. Nobody hired one of those inspectors, and they were A-level, to go out and help them out for a short period of time. So just to continue to lower the standard for inspectors and for health and safety, when we're charging plenty of money for permits, and I guess I have a problem, maybe we need to look at some of the admin costs from these building departments that seems to be running anywhere from about 25 to 55% in administrative costs, to get this somewhat under control. We in the industry all support good inspections and permits. We believe in consumer protection. But I think it's a little bit running astray. That's why the 512 and the 587 is to try to get some of this back under control a little bit. I think there's plenty of inspectors to go around. Sure, the money might not be right. Maybe they need to belly up the hard, pay a little bit more money to get a good qualified inspector. But I have to oppose both these bills.
Thank you. Joe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. Our division adopts the rules and qualifies individuals to set the certification exam. Decentralizing that decision-making process to as many as 120 counties and cities, we believe, would create a situation where really there was no one accountable for the quality of inspections being provided in our state. Those inspectors are responsible for ensuring the structural and life safety of the citizens of Oregon and the buildings that are built here. We believe certification must be coupled with practical on-the-job experience as an essential component of qualifying an effective inspector or plans examiner. The bill as written, Senate Bill 785, lines 16 through 19, would in effect let, in our reading, anyone in the municipality determine if someone was qualified to sit for an exam. It's not clear to the division that we would have authority to limit who may do so, and it's not clear that the division would have any authority in terms of oversight of that process. We believe that this whole process must have four critical elements. We must maintain a significant portion of the current required on-the-job experience. You heard a little bit about the rules review that went on in the advisory committee. The advisory committee was considering lowering the or considering a provisional or conditional certification for an individual that had half the experience that was necessary by the current rules. Consider that in light of the fact that within the past 2 years we've reduced the experience requirements from 5 years to 4 years. So now we've went from 5 to 4, we're at 2. So where do we stop? And when we believe that the provisional or conditional certification process would have been a real problem from an administrative standpoint. That coupled with the fact that this bill was introduced, we simply decided to cancel the hearing on that issue and wait and see if we got policy direction on this matter. We believe that the central responsibility and authority must be maintained for determining the minimum experience requirements, an applicant's qualifications, and approving the applicant should be as simple and straightforward as possible, and we certainly concur. We want to have as many good, qualified inspectors out there in the field as we possibly can. I think it's important to note that the division does not have a problem finding qualified individuals. I think it's an oversimplification to say that because we have standards in our state, we can't find qualified people. I think pay levels, quality of the work life, work environment, as well as quality of the environment that folks live in, go to the issues of who's going to be willing to go where to work as an inspector. So with that, there was a comment about 512, Senate Bill 512. I think the important distinction between that and 785 is the review referred to in Senate Bill 512 was BCD staff in conjunction with that board, not a municipality off determining on its own who should be qualified to sit for the exam. So we believe strongly that this bill should be opposed, and we hope for consideration of our testimony with respect to it. Senate Bill 1239, I was pleased to see that it was amended. I hadn't had a chance to see those amendments. I'd be happy to sit down and talk with the proponents of the bill. I'd like my staff to take a look at it from the standpoint of fiscal impact to see what the additional workload would cost. There were references to injured workers and people who retire to become inspectors. Shemeketa Community College has a two-year program where individuals can become qualified. If you take the two-year program at Shemeketa and you've got your ICBO certification, I believe there's one other requirement, and pass our exam, you can come out as a B-level inspector. We have A-level, that's commercial, hospitals, high-rises, that things of that nature. B-level, that's the low-end commercial work that Mr. Cross was referring to, 4,000 square foot and below. And then we have one and two family dwelling inspectors. One and two family dwelling inspectors can now become cross-certified through a training program that their building official conducts. So if this bill had moved forward as originally proposed, an individual would be able to come in as a plumbing inspector, get all the certifications under one and two family dwelling, and then move up and be an A-level inspector, perhaps with no experience in those fields, other than the training that was conducted in his own jurisdiction. So we were concerned about that bill. I just wanted the committee to be aware there is a process, there is another avenue to become certified as an inspector. That's through your community college system. And we certainly approve many of those candidates to sit for our exams now. Our exams test code knowledge. They don't screen for customer service skills. I think that truly is the job of the local building official to see who's going to fit well on their team and who's going to deal with their customers best. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions?
John, just a little confused. We had previous testimony, and this relates specifically to more 785, but previous testimony indicated that there were not enough people challenging for jobs and that there simply was a shallow pool. You indicated that you haven't had any problem finding those, and maybe, you know, living conditions or pay wages. He was talking specifically about Grants Pass and Salem and Astoria. I mean, you mean people don't want to work there, or is this, these are just isolated instances, and everywhere else there's an abundance of inspectors looking for jobs?
Through the chair to Senator Metzger, no, I would certainly never say that anyone wouldn't want to live in Grants Pass. I think it's one of the most beautiful areas of the state. I enjoy working in Salem myself, and I think the other choice is Astoria. That's lovely. I love the beach here. I think the point is folks who are competing for inspection resources are also competing with the construction industry. Many of these folks are qualified, have been on the job sites that they're inspecting. That's the key element of the quality that's maintained here in Oregon. So that inspector, unless he's reached an age where he doesn't want to go back out in the field, has a decision to make. Do I want to work with the tools? Do I want to go to work for a jurisdiction? Competition amongst the jurisdictions for inspection resources is very key. I mean, it's very intense. I think Mr. Wright's point about sharing resources and getting beyond the boundary lines, the sandboxes that we've created for ourselves, to a point where we're relating to the customer's needs more effectively, that's the key.
I'm not sure I got the answer, but that's fine. Thank you,
Mr.
Mr. Chairman, if I might try again.
Sure.
Again, Senator.
Are there enough inspectors out there or not?
Senator Metzger, we're not having a problem finding inspectors, although I do have a couple of individuals on our staff who are very good at recruiting. I'm aware some jurisdictions do have a problem, and it appears to be perennial. The reason for those difficulties in recruiting, I can't speak to.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Since we have some amendments there, I think you folks can maybe sit down and see if you can look something out, and we'll revisit this. So I'll close the public hearing. We won't go into work session. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 953. Patrick Jones, the foundation, and Michael Scott. I mean, Joe Landry, right? Joe out there someplace?
Yeah.
Okay, I figured this. Yeah. You can sit right behind the chair there and look at these guys. Welcome, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pat Jones. I'm here today on behalf of the National Association of Credit Management, which has sponsored Senate Bill 953. and I'm also and has 1,150 members in the state of Oregon. I'm also here on behalf of my company, Consolidated Supply Company, which is a wholesale provider of water, plumbing and waterworks materials. I've been a credit manager for Consolidated Supply Company for the last 14 years. We have a number of other representatives here today, other credit managers in the industry. We've held it to a couple of people to save time for the committee and to try to be concise on this bill.
We do have to say goodbye soon. You can't be too generous. We do have one other witness besides the four people that did call, so we have one.
Thank you for your generous offer.
maybe you don't quite have to answer. How about 15 or so? How about somewhere around 10 trail? How's that sound?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Each contractor in the state of Oregon is required to post a bond for protection of homeowners and non-owner claimants. These bonds range in amount from $2,000 to $10,000. There is a process. If you have a claim against one of these contractors for defective work or unpaid materials, we have the ability to file a claim. The basic way that works is that the homeowners have the first priority to recover against the bond. We agree with that concept, and we think that is how it should be. Non-owner claimants, suppliers, and subcontractors have been limited to a maximum recovery against that bond to an amount of $2,000. Even if the outstanding debt from the contractor is $10,000, if more than one non-owner files a claim, they split the $2,000. For example, if I file a claim on behalf of Consolidated Supply for $10,000, we haven't been paid for $10,000 worth of materials, and Tom here files a claim on behalf of his company for $10,000 in unpaid materials, we are only able to recover $1,000 each, a pro rata split of the $2,000. If there are no owner claims against the contractor, $8,000 of the bond goes unused. This has happened over and over again to our company and many other companies in our organization. There's also provisions for commercial claims. In order to file a commercial claim, we're required to spend money on court costs and attorney's fees to get a judgment before the claim can even be filed with the construction contractor's board. Then we go through the pro rata split process again. This $2,000 limit to non-owner claims has been on the books for many years. Today, $2,000 isn't a lot of money when you're talking about a construction project. At our company, you may be able to buy one night bathroom for $2,000. And our accounts carry much higher balances than they have in the past. Prices have escalated. Since the legislature provided us access to the bond, we've spoken with Ken Tidell of the Construction Contractors Board, the administrator for the board, and he has confirmed our suspicion that many times the contractor does not pay the material suppliers. He takes care of the owners. There are no owner claims. And that $8,000 of this $10,000, which is the general most of a $10,000 bond, goes unused because there are no homeowner claims. The $2,000 limit is basically insufficient to recover the multiple debts of a contractor. As a result, many subs and suppliers in the industry don't even bother to file claims because of the lack of chance of recovery. We believe this hurts the Construction Contractors Board's mission to protect the public. We think that fewer construction liens will be filed against homeowners if we're allowed access to the full extent of the bond.
And it will encourage plans to be filed by material suppliers, and the Construction Contractors Board will be in a far better position to recognize and take action against contractors that are responsible for claims and problems. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. If we want to go through the panel, we do have a question first. Anybody here? Please introduce yourself, sir, and proceed.
My name is Tom Akins. I'm the corporate credit manager for Ivy High Lift in Eugene. And I want to thank you, Chair Nelson, for allowing us to talk today. We've reviewed Mr. Cadell's letter to Senator Beyer of April 20th. I think you may have that. We're pleased that the CCB does not oppose the concept behind this bill. We agree that with the CCB that the owner should have priority. We can support the amendment, the spirit of the amendment that he's talking about. However, the amendment is confusing, the language is confusing, and it may need some work. We stand ready to work with Mr. Cadell and the CCB to clean up that language in the amendment. Insurance companies will probably claim that the original intent of the bond was to protect homeowners. That may be true, but the legislature somewhere online saw value in including non-owners in the process, and access to the bond has been available to non-owners for many years. All contractors must be registered with the CCB, including contractors who work on commercial projects. The simple fact is that the bond protects more than just homeowners, so this argument really can't be made anymore. Insurers will also argue that non-owners' access to the full amount of the bond will mean increased loss experience, and that would lead to an increase in premiums, keeping some contractors out of the industry. It's our understanding from talking with contractors that the cost, the premiums for the bond are less than $200 a year. We request that maybe you ask those who represent the insurance industry how much an average annual premium is for a $10,000 and a $5,000 bond. We believe you will find that the annual premiums are not a significant factor in the cost of doing business for a contractor, nor will the increase be a burdensome amount if they do have to increase the premium. The benefits of this bill far outweigh any increase in the cost of the bond. 953 will benefit owners. We anticipate that fewer construction needs to be filed. Non-owner claimants will have a more economical and less traumatic approach to resolving a non-payment problem than going the legal route of lien and foreclosure. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this measure. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Scott. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Equipment Rental Association. I also happen to be an attorney with the firm of Fur & Scott, located in Tigard. I specialize in construction litigation and design litigation. Speaking on behalf of Senate Bill 953, first understand what the bill doesn't do. What the bill doesn't do is shorten the time period for homeowners or anyone else to make a claim. Okay? It doesn't do that. All it talks about is if funds remain after homeowner claims have been paid, that remaining portion of the bond should be paid to non-owner claimants. Mr. Akins talked briefly about insurance. There's a little bit of a difference between insurance and surety. Under suretyship law, which is what this bond is, the suretyship attempts to recover the dollars it pays out to those people. Unlike your insurance company, when they pay out on a claim, they may increase your premiums at a later date, but they don't come back and say, I paid someone so-and-so to sell you the claim. Here, under suretyship law, the surety does have that obligation to come back and say, I paid out these dollars. I'd like you to pay those dollars back to me. That's the difference generally between insurance and suretyship law. The Construction Contractors Board has, I just saw some modifications that they'd like to propose. they suggest in their language that there be a longer period of time for homeowners to have access to that bond. I don't disagree with that, but here's the, I guess, the decision for this committee. Right now, if a homeowner files a claim on day one, it starts a 90-day time period. Now, the issue then becomes, well, that homeowner uses up the entire bond. Do you want to say, tell you what we'd rather have is a 120-day time period where those homeowners all share pro rata, or we're happy with the 3 months time period. We think that's enough, because if you file within that same 90-day time period, all those homeowners, whether you filed on the first day or filed on the second day, up to the 89th day or the 90th day, will share equally against that bond. We think that's correct. The Construction Contractors Board has raised a concern that maybe that should go out for a year. I think that's a little bit long, and the reason why is I think that homeowners need to be diligent in what they're doing. If you're talking about you have a year to file a claim, and then you have a year after that as you go through that process, remember, that bond may still be gone for that homeowner who files on the 91st day. So what you'd ask yourself is, do we want to extend this period of time for a year? Or what we'd rather do is allow homeowners to share pro rata as it relates to that bond. And then, once that reasonable time period has expired, that other people would be able to have access to the bond. Previous legislative sessions, previous legislators have said, the reasonable period of time is 3 months, 90 days, to let homeowners say, homeowners, you have first crack at the bond. Do what you need to do. It's enough time to learn about your claim. It's enough time to also to try to resolve your claim with the homeowner. And all you need to do is file your claim. The CCB has proposed legislative changes to this bill that say the one-year time period begins to run on the first date on a claim that results in payment from the surety bond. Well, that means that if I called up and said, hello, CCB, I'd like to know if the one-year time period is start, even though Mr. Jones and Mr. Akins have filed a claim, the answer to that question would be, you know, I don't know, because we don't know if their claims have resulted in payment yet. We still need to go through the entire administrative process to find out, one, whether there's a proposed and final order issued in favor of Mr. Akins' client or in favor of Mr. Akins' company or Mr. Jones' company, and then we need to find out whether those are paid. My suggestion is simply, rather than all the language that is there, is make it simple. So people don't have to go to me. So people don't have to go to the lawyer and say, what's that mean? When do I file the claim? It's to tell people, be diligent. Your rights are protected. You come first, but here's what you need to do. I think this bill does that. To the extent the CCB has concerns about homeowner claims maybe being subject to some type of a loss, I disagree with that, particularly in the first 90 days. We'd be happy to talk with them about those issues, because we do want to maintain homeowner priority, but we want to make sure it's maintained for all of the homeowners and all the general public. Thank you.
Questions? I was just going to ask you a specific example, but I think you just explained that, so I appreciate that. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Joe, you want to... Welcome, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Joe Landry. I'm voting for John Gervais today on behalf of Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning National Association, the National Electrical Contractors Association, and the Construction Industry Committee. And we just want to make the statement that all three of these groups support this bill as it originally drafted.
They're in support, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. We talked about some amendments, is that?
Well,
we don't have the official amendments, but
yeah, they talked about it.
Yeah, but
we need it.
Okay.
Jerry Vanskoy with the Associated Floor Covering Contractors, and I think you have my hand out there. I apologize, I didn't get. I thought I was coming up with the other game, but I got finished out.
I'm sure, Joe. Right.
We're also in support of this bill, and our contractors, floor covering contractors, are come on the job site at the tail end of the job, and when we're looking at residential work in particular, we just find ourselves in a position of maybe doing the work and all the money has been dispersed out of the construction account. So the fact that we're on the tail end of the job, we have maybe a few more collection problems than some of the contractors. So that's, I guess, is our keen interest in this bill. I don't think, in looking at the statistical data furnished by the CCB, I see that we have a shortfall a non-owner claim shortfall of about $1.7 million. That's non-owner claims. I think Mr. Crudell probably will maybe go over some of those figures, but I'm looking at the figures from his office. This isn't a something that's used oftentimes because the sum is so low that I know a lot of our members are going to look here, especially if the builder should go broke. This basically, if he isn't broke, if he's going to stay in business, then it could be that we could file a lien maybe, and maybe we might get paid if we can perfect that. But when you go broke is when we have the problem, and it could be that there aren't any homeowner claims at all. So if there's, say, a $10,000 bond, and there aren't any homeowner claims at all, then it just seems to me that it would be appropriate that the whatever contractors and suppliers might try to attach the bond, that they should be able to get more than just $2,000. So I think that when we have to write off our losses, bad debts, that it's just like a bankruptcy, it's just like stolen merchandise. I think it increases the cost of doing business. So in that respect, I think that it's a consumer protection law for everyone, because we just assume be competitive and keep our prices as low as possible. Thank you.
Any questions?
You talked a moment ago about having to write off the debt. In reality, does that happen that often, or do you go ahead and seek remuneration from the owner through a lien for the product that was provided for the home site?
Chairman, Senator Metzger, I do not have any statistical data I don't see a whole bunch of liens. In fact, I'm thinking that's the same question to Mr. Cadell. There isn't a plethora of liens as a result of this thing at all, and I really don't know the when you look at this amount. If the builder's gone broke, then you really can't go to court because he doesn't have any assets. So then you turn and look at this, and of course, if this amount was increased, then I think that could have a positive impact, because certainly it would result in fewer liens. But that would be one avenue if you've given your notices. A lot of contractors do not give their notices. On housework, if you don't give your notice, everybody has to give a notice. And if you don't give the notice, then you don't have any lien rights. So I really can't give you a direct answer because I don't know.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. Appreciate your testimony. John, Ken, Kendall. Cadell, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Contractors Bonding and Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman, members, we oppose Senate Bill 953 because we see it as a vast departure from current policy, which has served consumers in Oregon very well. Under current laws, which was mentioned earlier, a general contractor has to have a $10,000 bond, and hopefully by the end of this session, with compromises on both sides, I think we're going to reach about a $15,000 bond. So that bond is scheduled to go up. The reason for that bond increase is some homeowners were exhausting the $10,000 bond. Owners, as has been pointed out, have priority in these particular bonds, and non-owners have a limit of $2,000. We have an administrative claims process in Oregon, which makes it very easy and consumer-friendly to file on the bonds and file claims with the contractor's board. This bill would eliminate those restrictions on the amount that non-owners can claim and really turns it into a collection agency for businesses. Businesses that do business with other businesses. And we think that that's headed into a very, very dangerous area. Our claim study shows that we would have 150% increase in payout under the effects of this bill. We currently, in raw numbers, get more non-owner claims than we do owner claims. The owner claims get the vast amount of the money, 75% of the money, from that claims process because they have priority and they have access to the full amount of the bond. currently non-owners collect about 25% of the money. So what's wrong with simply reversing that and making a fund available, 75% of it for non-owners and 25% of it for owners, if their rights are protected as Mr. Cadell's amendment would? The consequences are, one, along with the increase in the bond to $15,000 and this bill, a more than doubling of the premium. So what was an affordable premium now for some contractors becomes a burden. But probably more importantly is about a third of our business would have to be re-underwritten. As was pointed out by a previous speaker, bonding or suretyship contemplates the ability to at least attempt to recover assets. That's why the premiums are so low. If, in fact, this passes, then we've got to re-scrutinize a lot of those contractors. And remember, a lot of contractors are part-time. They're happy with a smaller volume of business. They don't necessarily highball all their work, so they're small. A lot of them are just starting out. They don't have a lot of assets. And so it's difficult for some of them, even under existing law, to qualify for bonds. And finally, if this passes and this burden is put on the bond, it's going to be very difficult in the future to increase the face amount of the bond. Because as you increase that, business then relies upon that in their lending policies to other businesses because they can collect under this. As a result, you cap that bond at a much lower amount and you can't raise it for the protection of homeowners in the future. And I just simply would give you the case of the state of Washington, where they have a $6,000 bond. It's been $6,000 for a long, long time. And in the state of Washington, contractors pay 20% more for a $6,000 bond than you pay for a $10,000 bond in Oregon. So you pay 20% more for 40% less. So the biggest public policy question, I think, in the long term, is going to be very difficult to increase the face amount of that bond and keep the premium affordable for contractors and the underwriting standards approachable for a goodly number of contractors. So in sum, we see this as changing something that's worked very well in Oregon, changing it to a basically a business collection agency as opposed to a consumer service model, and we would oppose its passage. Thank you.
Well, the question is asked, what are the premiums and how much
are they? Premiums for a $10,000 bond from our company range from $160 to $295, depending, again, on your experience and your asset base.
Okay. That's, and then what would they increase to? Would it keep...
If the bond increases to $15,000, this bill would pass, they would more than double.
So you go to $320 and $500 or something like that.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, there's one other factor that we have not... plugged into that equation, and two of the witnesses brought it keenly to my attention when they mentioned a lot of non-owners do not file claims now because the bond in essence is only amounts to $2,000, so they use other collection methods. If this passes and those additional people file claims, that's not figured into our 150% increase. That was actually taken from an active claims study model. If you add that incentive, it could be a lot more than that.
Okay. Ken, are there any other questions?
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Ken Cedale, Administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. The Construction Contractors Board at the meeting last month looked at this bill and said that they would not take a position on it to oppose the bill as long as the consumer didn't lose any of their claim rights. We've done something kind of to confuse things. In the first place, the method of filing claims, about 5,000 claims are filed per year. About 1,500 of those get to a final order. You know, it's only the final order ones that go to the bond company. So filing the claim is the thing that consumers need to be aware of, and that's in a different part of the statute. That's in ORS 701.145, and I think it's fairly plain. You could file a claim for 1 year after the work was completed or abandoned. If it was a spec-built home, why, there's a slightly longer period. But that's a period of time that you can file a claim. The bill, as worded, would, after the, in a 90-day time period, if a homeowner, no homeowner claims were filed, or if the homeowner claim didn't take the full $10,000, then the non-owner claims would have access to the rest of the bond. Currently, non-owner claimants have access to only $2,000. So, a 90-day period ends, and then another one starts. Homeowner claims have, again, priority over any other claims during that 90-day time period. If the full $2,000 was paid out the first time, or if it wasn't paid out, in any event, the homeowner filing the claim would still have access to, if there were no homeowner claims the first 90-day period, second 90-day period starts, the homeowner claim could come in and take the whole $10,000. If there was one non-owner claim filed the first time period, it took $2,000, but on the 91st day, there's still $8,000 left for the consumer. That's why we propose to go by a priority system, but say you have to leave that $8,000 there until the year is up, so make sure that the homeowners don't lose something they have now. That's the purpose for the amendment, and it does get to be very complex language. Michael Scott is correct. There's no way we can figure out how to write it, but it doesn't look complex. You're processing something and setting a priority in law. But it's clear as to when to file a claim. The other thing about claims is that it has not been brought up. See, one of the reasons that this has become a rather popular place to file a claim is about 6 or 8 years ago, you authorized the board to authorize these claims to be filed as a judgment. So coming to the CCB to get a final order, even if it's not paid in full, at least gives the party the chance to have that as a judgment. If there is anything out there from the contractor to be had.
Okay. Thank you for the question. Looks like that bill has a little work to do too, so we'll folks can get together and talk about things and we'll see what we can develop. We'll close public hearing on 953. Any further business before the committee? Committee adjourned.